sometimes you go out to eat at a restaurant, whatever. Fill in the blank with your favorite place. And sometimes you go out to eat at a buffet. Oh, yeah. Anything you could want served to you from a magical kitchen, making an endless feast of delights. Today, the Dananauts bring you just such a buffet, a smorgasbord of storage as we assault and pepper our guests with all sorts of questions. So first, before we introduce our guests, let me say hello to Mr. Chris Wall. Chris, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm spectacular. I'm like a diamond twinkling in the world of data center stuff today. I just made that up, but that's me. How about you?
Good deal, man. I am doing well as well. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter, Chris Wall at Chris Wall on Twitter. And our guest today is Howard Marks. Howard, would you introduce yourself to the Datanauts audience?
Sure. I break storage for a living. You know, basically, that's not hard, but I get to go into the details about why. I run Deep Storage, which is an independent test lab, and with Ray Lucchese, another storage analyst of advanced years, co-host the Graybeards on Storage podcast.
Oh, excellent. How could we find Graybeards on Storage?
Well, you know, you could go to iTunes, which is what most people do, or you can just enter it into that magic Google machine. And because Ray and I co-hosted, you know, we each have links to the RSS feed.
Howard, thanks for joining us on Datanauts. What we wanted to get into was just kind of asking you several different questions, hot topics, about what's going on in storage. Chris, did you want to kick it off?
Absolutely. And I got to say, I got to enjoy being a guest on the Graybeards podcast, which is awesome because I have a red beard. So I feel like I bucked the trend on that one. It's going on my LinkedIn profile as an endorsement if anyone wants to click the plus button next to it. As Ethan alluded, we're going to pick apart a bunch of different kind of ideas here around storage, from arrays to cloud to object to vVols and all that kind of jazz. But let's talk about array architecture as the opening round of questions here. The use of flash, is that pretty much pervasive across all storage arrays? Are they all using flash somewhere? Or do we still have things that either don't use flash in some piece of them or are all flash?
Not using flash has become the exception as opposed to the rule. We're pretty much the only place we're seeing all spinning disk is in the cheap and deep storage model that's used as a backup target or as a large scale object store. You know, if you've got multiple petabytes of streaming movies, then disks work fine. But for applications where small IOs are what determines how fast the application runs, which is most things that run off a database, flash is the place to go.
Okay, so you say all spinning disk would be the exception and not the rule. So everybody's got some kind of flash involved in their storage architecture.
Right.
Okay, so if I'm looking at an array, how do I choose all flash versus a hybrid quantity of flash and spinning Rust?
So the difference between an all flash system and a hybrid system is what happens to your colder data. If you are a large organization and you understand your data really well, then you can have your DBA once a month run a job that takes all the sales order and inventory pick detail from your SAP database and migrates it to an archive table space when a given line item has been ordered, paid, picked, shipped, delivered, etc., and is therefore old, stale data. If you're even a billion-dollar company, you don't have DBAs that understand your application that well because you bought Microsoft Dynamics. You didn't buy SAP and then spend 6 years modifying it specifically for your needs. But you still might have a database with 10 years worth of sales order information. So you there would be better off with a hybrid system that will separate the data to put the data that is being accessed frequently in flash and the data that's just sitting around because somebody, when they run the previous year comparison report, needs it to be there, runs from spinning disk.
Ultimately there, the distinction's going to be a cost one. If I have some significant amount of data that I don't need fast access to, I can save some money by making sure there's a lower tier for that slower access.
Right. In terms of raw media, enterprise SSD today costs about 25 times as much as an 8 terabyte hard disk on a cost per gigabyte basis. So for that data that's got low access frequency or low I/O frequency, disks work fine and are a lot cheaper. Now, the question is, do you have enough data to make it matter? And what is the penalty in your organization for missing your performance targets by a little? Because the advantage of an all-flash system is that the performance is consistent. In a hybrid system, performance may vary depending on what users are doing on any given day and how much they're accessing that cold data. So what we sometimes see is people say, well, 3 years ago, I bought a VMAX and I had $1 million to spend. And the truth is, I bought that VMAX because it was fast, not because it had six nines of reliability. Today, I can afford an all-flash system that doesn't quite have the reliability of the VMAX, but has plenty of reliability for what I need, you know, four or five nines for less than I spent the last time. Therefore, it's less than my available budget. And since I can afford it, why not?
It's interesting that you bring that up. I was talking to a colleague the other day, and we were remembering doing performance based on disk and not even worrying about capacity, because it was just, I can get X number of IO, let's say 100 or 200 IO per disk. And then we were debating on, do I want a 600 gig fiber channel disk? Do I want a SAS disk, et cetera? And just doing the math to multiply out, I'm going to need 270 disks at this IO.
Right. And it always came out that I needed four times as much capacity to deliver the IOs as the data was going to take up. We have to actually start thinking about performance requirements for storage in terms of IO density. How many IOPS per gigabyte do I need? And if that IOPS per gigabyte is high, flash is a great solution. If the IOPS per gigabyte is really low, disks work. In the middle, either one could be a good solution.
Now, what about architectures that would, you mentioned cold data, meaning not accessed very frequently, and then I would imagine hot would be accessed quite frequently.
Right.
What about the arrays that would tier? It would all land on hot, and then based on some kind of algorithm would shift to a different tier of capacity disks. Are they still around?
They are still around, but they're primarily older systems that have had flash added. That the real question you want to ask about a hybrid system is, how reactive is it? When my workloads change, how quickly and how well does the system react? And in general, systems that are based on caching, where the algorithm is deciding in real time constantly what data is important to keep in the flash, are more reactive. They react faster than systems that are based on tiering, which move the data from disk to flash, as opposed to keeping another copy in flash. Some of the legacy tiered systems move very large chunks of data. So if you have an index in your Oracle database that's 100K that's being hammered, you might have to take the surrounding gigabyte of data, which isn't so hot, along with it. And some of them only move that data overnight, which is kind of the worst of all possible worlds. It's like driving your car by looking in the rearview mirror and trying to make sure that the yellow lines stay even. Works fine as long as you're going down a perfectly straight road in the middle of Nebraska. But as soon as there's a curve, you find out about it because you've driven off the road. And so with those hybrid systems that only move data once a day, end of month is a really bad day, because you run the end of month processes and they're all slow because you didn't run end of month processes yesterday. So the data they need wasn't what was in the flash. And then the day after, the system goes, oh, I'm going to get all ready for what he did yesterday, which you're not going to do for another month. And so the day after runs slow too.
It sounds like there's some definite caveats with the architecture. I've never used one of those systems personally, but I remember, I think it was Equalogic came out with the idea, or was it Compellent?
Compellent started it
even
before there was flash. And it was really one of those, works really well if you do exactly the same thing every day. But as your workloads change, it's just not reactive enough.
Let's scratch the surface on the term flash, because it seems pretty generic. And I hear it used in storage arrays and a number of different technologies that go with it. I hear SSDs, PCIe flash, NVMe. There's now flash that can be inserted into a DIMM-based kind of socket architecture. Explain what the flash is in these systems and what the architectures are for the flash.
Okay, so to start from the very bottom, flash memory is a non-volatile, that means when you turn the power off, the data doesn't go away, solid-state memory type that can be rewritten. And it stores a bit as charge. So for every cell with the simplest form of flash, which is called SLC or single-level cell, you look in a cell and there's either a charge in there or there isn't, and there being a charge is a 1 and there not being a charge is a 0. For multi-level cell, the most common type, there are 4 charge levels, so it's 2 logical bits stored in each cell. So if it's from 0 to 1 volt, it's a 1, and if it's from 1 to 2 volts, it's a 2, and so forth. The very nature of flash is kind of weird, that reading flash is simple. You can read flash very quickly, and it's relatively straightforward. Writing flash, however, is more complicated. First of all, flash is organized into pages, and you have to write a whole page at a time. And the pages are then organized into blocks, and you have to erase a whole block at a time. So, you know, think of it as an etch-a-sketch. You can draw whatever you want, but when you erase it, you have to turn the whole thing over and shake it and erase the whole page. Erasing requires about 24 volts as opposed to the about 2 volts it takes to read and write. And that wears out the insulating layers between the cells, so you can only survive so many write-erase cycles for each type of flash. So this weird stuff now has to be made to look like either memory or storage to the processor of some system that's going to end up being our storage array. And the usual way to do this is to buy a chip that runs the flash on the back end and has an interface on the front end that's SAS or SATA or PCIe. And with the PCIe, traditionally, that's been with a software interface ACHI, so it looks like a SATA drive.
Just to make sure I'm on the right page here, we're saying there's a number of mechanics within the flash that change versus magnetic drives, but on the front end, the actual interface is just merely a way to make that new architecture compatible with the interfaces within a server, PCIe right. as an example, SATA, that kind of jazz.
Right. So there's the physical and the electrical interface, and then there's the logical or software interface.
All right. And I'm on board.
And so traditionally, we've had SAS and SATA SSDs that look like disks. And because flash is weird and it only has a certain amount of write endurance and you have to erase whole pages, and that could lead to really funky latency spikes as the system doesn't have a free page and has to garbage collect to make it, different SSDs have different amounts of flash relative to their published size. So an 800 gigabyte SSD might have a terabyte of flash. It might have a little bit more than a terabyte of flash, depending on how much it's intended to be written to. And then we can build systems up from this and say, okay, I'm going to do the very basic thing. I'm going to take all the physical hard drives out of an array that I've been selling for years, and I'm going to replace them with SSDs. And that's roughly what NetApp did with their EF series. And that works fine, except that RAID wasn't designed to minimize the number of times that it wrote to spinning disks, because spinning disks don't care how many times you write to them. And so running conventional RAID on top of SSDs means you write more data and therefore wear them out faster. And so a vendor who just took their standard system and slapped in SSDs has to buy more expensive SSDs to provide the same warranty life or service life that a vendor who wrote their software to treat the flash very gently could get away with using less expensive SSDs and less flash and less over-provisioning to provide that same amount of performance and capacity. Mm.
So we still have a cost sensitivity in the flash world, of course.
Yes, we do. However, while the architecture matters in terms of the kinds of things that I just talked about, what kind of SSD you need. I think customers have to remember that all that means is the vendor has additional costs. And if he's not passing them on to me, but eating them in terms of slightly lower margin than the guy who's got the newer software, as far as I'm concerned as a customer, that's perfectly valid.
Let me throw one more flash array architecture scenario by you, Howard. Let's say that I did decide to use flash in production, and now I'm in a disaster recovery scenario. I need to replicate data to a secondary site. How do I justify another flash array for disaster recovery, or do I? Should I go some other route in that scenario?
Here you face some interesting conundrums. Traditionally, we prefer to do large-scale replication in the array rather than in the host. And that means you need basically the same array to pitch and to catch the data. Now, the advantage is if you're doing that with an all-flash array, to make the cost of flash comparable to the cost of using disk for performance, the all-flash arrays do data reduction and they compress and deduplicate the data, which of course reduces your bandwidth requirement when you're replicating the data as well. If you're trying to do disaster recovery under the assumption that, well, most of my users aren't going to be in the day after the disaster because their house is flooded, so my demand is reduced, and therefore I can get away with spinning disks in the DR site. The problem there is then you have to manage the replication in the host to go from one type of storage to another. It'll work. It just becomes much more operationally complicated.
Right. And then because you have that performance mismatch, you've got some amount of delay, you're saying, baked into the replication cycle because the remote site's always going to be some level behind.
Yeah. So if you're looking for RPO of zero, to never lose any data, that requires synchronous replication. And then the performance of the system at your DR site is going to affect the performance of your applications at your primary site as well, because data has to be written to both systems before it's acknowledged to the application. If you were trying to save a couple of bucks and use your old disk system at the DR site,
your whole application performance just got diminished to as quickly as that spinning disk can write.
To your old system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and if you have to declare DR, I'm thinking if your application is assuming it's going to get tens of thousands, whatever it needs, a lot of performance, and it comes to a four-year-old crappy array, that's not going to be good.
Well, within reason, because remember, it was sharing that new array with test and dev, and since we're having a disaster, test isn't testing and dev isn't devving. So, okay. Yeah, there's a little bit of overhead there, but I would rather have, in a disaster situation, not have my DR site be more than two or three times slower than my primary.
That was enlightening. I think we could go nerdy on how flash works for hours and I wouldn't be bored, but perhaps that's just me. Ethan, I tell you, hearing that there's extra capacity in a flash device to kind of be used as cells and pages wear out, that's interesting. It may have a terabyte, but only advertises 800 gigabyte just because it knows that it's going to need areas to, I guess, replace itself. Almost like a self-healing drive. I thought that was neat.
I grasp that bit that you were just talking about as well. Pretty fascinating how flash is working under the hood. I've always focused on its short lifespan, relatively speaking, because it can only deal with a certain number of reads and writes. Hearing more of the mechanics from Howard was great. The thing that I grabbed a hold of was Howard's notion of IOPS per gigabyte, which I assume the way he was talking about it is like he said we should be thinking about this as storage people, IOPS per gigabyte. So I'm assuming it's not a standard metric that's out there, but I was really mesmerized by that idea because he brought up the point that maybe you have a certain performance requirement, and depending on the class of disk or the type of array you're looking at, you might have to buy tons and tons of storage and populate it with all kinds of disk interfaces just to get throughput. You don't need the storage, you just need the throughput. And that's sort of insane. And this notion of IOPS per gigabyte would give you a metric to help you match what storage array you're looking at with the sort of performance that you require in a more straightforward way.
I like that you think that buying storage to get the performance and just having this extra capacity is insane, because that was how we did it. So that gives me a big smile to hear you say that.
Hi, Data Knots listeners. This is Drew Conry Murray from the Packet Pushers. I'm poking my head in here to thank today's sponsor, Viptela. So you've probably been hearing a lot about software-defined WANs. Viptela's hybrid SD-WAN technology unifies your MPLS, leased line, and internet-based wide area network infrastructure into a single service platform. A Viptela SD-WAN combines authentication, encryption, segmentation, and service chaining to bring data isolation all the way to branch network CPE. SD-WANs have become a hot topic because they should deliver flexibility and choice to enterprises, and Viptela does just that. For example, you could move from a dual MPLS to dual broadband, or you can combine MPLS and broadband with LTE backup. And this kind of change can lead to real cost savings, up to 45% per branch location. Or you could take your WAN management in-house and build a single overlay using multiple service providers or carriers. You can buy bandwidth and circuits from anyone, but manage the application performance with the visibility tools in Viptela's platform. So if you're in the process of a wide area network refresh, the Viptela SD-WAN solution can cut your costs while boosting your bandwidth and agility. And Viptela has successful deployments with brand name customers, and it's the only WAN you'll ever need. Also, the Packet Pushers are recording a live podcast with Viptela at the ONUG conference. So if you're in New York City on November 4th, come join us to meet the Packet Pushers and hear from Viptela customers about real-world SD-WAN deployments. And now, back to Ethan and Chris.
So, Howard, we just covered a bunch of different questions about array architecture and different scenarios about flash. Let's move into cloud and object storage. And let's start with cloud storage first. What types of storage are available in the cloud?
Well, first you have to differentiate between storage for compute that's running in the cloud and storage in the cloud for compute that's running on your premises. So if you're running EC2 instances in AWS as your compute, then there is block storage available called EBS, Elastic Block Storage. But I assume that's not really what you're asking about. I think you're really more talking about using services like S3 or Glacier that are object storage and let me access infinite pool of storage from my premises whenever I need to.
Exactly right.
And I think that's a good clarification point because it feels like quote unquote cloud storage is a way to say object storage that's not in your data center. It's almost become the same term.
Yeah, because S3 was the first major cloud storage service. And so we all kind of look at it and go, well, yeah, that's what we mean by cloud storage, of course.
I don't think a lot of people are hooking up, I would hope, iSCSI over cloud or something like that.
Well, remember,
you're doing the tape libraries, maybe, I don't know.
You know, remember that is what Store Simple set out to do, was to be a cloud gateway with iSCSI so that you could use S3 as your storage.
Really? So you do, yeah. iSCSI over internet?
Yeah.
I guess that's what the I stands for anyways, so.
Well, the problem is that doing that with a little gateway and with S3 as the ultimate destination and with, you know, indeterminate latency meant that you had really lousy performance, and eventually.
That's why I was chuckling. It was the latency and the unpredictability of it, especially.
Right. And so eventually Store Simple just became Microsoft's solution for how you back up to Azure. For that kind of streaming application, it works okay. Now, that's not to say you can't run primary storage applications in somebody else's data center with the compute in your data center. It just means you need something more than just a gateway. So the folks at Clear Sky Data have a service that runs that way, where they put a flash appliance that does iSCSI, by the way, because Laz was one of the primary engineers at Equalogic. But that does its main storage to a Clear Sky Data point of presence in your metropolitan area. So it's just metro Ethernet, 5 or 6 millisecond latency, not, oh, I sent it to S3, it could take 50 milliseconds to get an ACK back kind of latency.
You've been talking about object storage. Maybe this is a good time just to clarify that. What exactly is object storage specifically as compared to what else?
So object storage is just another protocol for accessing storage. Ever since the invention of the disk drive, or, okay, not quite, ever since the invention of SCSI, we've had block storage where you can read and write a block to a logical disk. Since Novell came around, we've had file storage where you could remotely access a file on a NAS or a file server. So object storage is just a modified model that was primarily designed to solve the scalability problems of file storage, the file systems having to provide POSIX ACLs and in record locks and other functionality of that type needed a lot of metadata about each file in the system. And they wouldn't scale to billions of files. Object storage, instead of using a file protocol like NFS or SMB, uses HTTP, and access to those objects is based on HTTP gets and puts. And so each object, and an object is essentially a file, has a unique URL, and the agents can get and put those files, and it can scale ridiculously large, you know, beyond anybody's ability to actually buy that much hardware today.
Hmm.
Now, one of the usual features of object storage is that those objects are immutable. You can't make changes in place. And so if you want to modify an object, you get it, make the changes on your local system, and then put a new object that's a linked new version of that object. And that kind of thing becomes the basis for applications like sync and share, where there's just putting new versions of objects into S3 and then presenting them via Dropbox or the equivalent at your machine as if they were another folder.
Okay, so block storage, we're updating blocks, whatever size your partition is of data, and saying, here's some new data, give me what you have. It's kind of this very transactional conversation.
It means that each client is responsible for knowing everything because there's sure. no file system index behind it.
Whereas with the object storage, we are just saying, I need this, some kind of unique identifier, grab me this thing, I'm going to get it, I'm going to manipulate it, I'll give it back to you in its new form, and then it has a new identifier after I store it? Or is it right. The old identifier?
No, it's got a new identifier that's linked to the old identifier.
I'm hearing this, and it sounds like there's got to be some reason to make this more attractive. It sounds like probably a mix between financials and the scale that you mentioned, because I know block, it's very hard to scale it out to any meaningful size.
Right. Well, with block, you can't scale it because you can't coordinate. The clustered file system gets out of hand. By moving to a NAS, you move responsibility for knowing where everything is to the NAS head. But again, it can only scale so big. And with object storage, you can very easily design a system where the metadata is divided up by what the first digit of the URL is or something. And so you can scale ridiculously large. When I was working at BBDO, which is an advertising agency, we built digital content management systems so they could keep track of all the commercials they'd ever made. And object storage is the perfect place to keep that kind of thing, or medical x-rays, or any other kind of, we're creating very large quantities of semi-structured data that we need to keep for a long time.
So that sounds like good reasons to go with object storage as a customer. Is it kind of the same reasons for the person providing the object storage to go with object, meaning it's really easy to scale out, I don't have to build these little silos of storage? Because you mentioned that Amazon does offer block storage, so there's got to be some reason that it seems that object storage is so pervasive for cloud providers to offer to customers.
Well, block storage is expensive because you have to provide IOPS and performance.
Ah, okay.
Object storage is very latency insensitive because it's HTTP. And so I say here, get me that file. And if you did that on block storage and it took a second to respond, it would cause applications all sorts of problems. But if you get 1 second response time from an HTTP source, you know, your applications are written to be multi-threaded and making multiple requests. And it's just more in line with your expectations. From the provider's point of view, object storage is almost always provided as scale out storage as software on industry standard servers. Even if you go to somebody like HGST, who's a client of mine, or CleverSafe or EMC, when you buy their object storage system, you get a whole bunch of 2U servers full of 7,200 RPM drives. And if you fill those up, you just add more nodes to it and say, here, expand into that. If you're the more the rule your own kind, then you go get Ceph or Swift or one of the other open source projects and start spreading it across a whole bunch of servers that you bought from Quanta or Supermicro.
So reading through cloud storage and object storage, to me, this is more of the cutting edge stuff. I wouldn't say it's cutting edge, means this technology has been around for a bit, but some of it for a guy like me that doesn't deal in storage all the time, these were some newer concepts and ideas. And as we were getting into kind of the rudiments and the basics of object storage with Howard, he was describing how it works. He mentioned that object storage uses HTTP, gets and puts. And I was like, oh, I know what that is. I have been dealing with HTTP servers and services for a long time now, way down at the packet level if I've needed to on occasion. So when he put it that way, object storage uses HTTP gets and puts. Each file is an object, which gives you a tremendous mechanism that you can use to scale it. Objects are immutable. You change them locally to write them back out as a new object with a reference to the old object, etc. It all very quickly came into my head how that works. And I'm sort of tempted to put a packet sniffer like Wireshark on my computer, look at Dropbox reads and writes, and wondering if I can actually see HTTP in action there or not.
I'm just kind of disappointed that you're not already doing that, Ethan.
I know, right? What kind of a network guy am I?
It's like you're admitting your shame. No, I think the one thing that stood out for me was that you hear cloud storage, and it doesn't really mean anything. A lot of people tend to associate that with object storage, but it could really be anything. It's kind of a poor term. So I'm going to start trying personally to just say it's object storage, either on or off-prem. And that to me is a little bit better than saying cloud storage, just because that seems cloudy. I don't know, a bad joke, but they tend to be used interchangeably, and they're not necessarily the same thing. Man, so we've talked storage architecture. I got kind of nerdy about Flash. I enjoyed getting into the weeds on that a little bit. And I think we had a good kind of intro discussion to cloud storage, object storage, what the differences are. Let's pick apart a third topic here, and that's VMware's virtual volumes, or vVols, something relatively new, although I've heard VMware spouting about it for probably the last 4 or 5 years. So Howard, you're obviously a very respected authority on virtual volumes. I've actually been to a number of events where VMware had you up there talking with them. Seems to be something unique versus the traditional way of consuming block or maybe even file consumption. Can you lay it out? What is virtual volumes and what does it do?
Sure. Virtual volumes aligns the unit of storage management with the unit of compute management, the VM. Back in the day when we did storage for physical servers, we really had a small number of physical servers. I was the Windows guy, and I'd be building Active Directory and Exchange, and all of those systems would have direct attached storage, and my clients would have a handful, maybe two dozen RS6000s or Suns running Oracle and their other mission critical applications connected to the SAN. And in those days, that meant that you would create SAN volumes, and those SAN volumes would belong to one and only one machine. And so if you wanted to take a snapshot of the Oracle database, well, that SAN volume was all that was on the Oracle database, and you could use the NetApp snapshot function to get a copy of that Oracle database in a matter of seconds. When we started virtualizing servers, there were good reasons to put the x86 machines on the SAN, vMotion being the top of the list. But we were now virtualizing so many x86 Windows and Linux machines that we were incapable of staying with the each virtual machine gets one or more volumes from the SAN. On top of everything else, SCSI limited vCenter or vSphere to 255 volumes per cluster. And so if I had more than 255 VMs, I absolutely needed to create to put more than one VM in a volume.
Or less VMs and just 4 or 5 virtual disks per VM potentially.
Right, or 4 or 5 Oracle virtual disks per VM, or the virtualization guys and the storage guys don't want to actually every morning sit down and provision more volumes. So the storage guys give the virtualization guys big volumes and say, here, put all your VMs in there. And, you know, regardless of why we did it, we ended up cramming VMs into SAN volumes like they cram housing into the favelas overlooking Rio de Janeiro. We just stuck them in there any place we could. And that meant that all the functionality in the storage array became useless. If you took a snapshot of a volume that had 10 VMs, then it was a big snapshot because there was 10 VMs in it. And none of those VMs could be application consistent because you couldn't quiesce them. The timing makes it impossible to quiesce more than one VM at the same time anyway. Basically, using array snapshots for managing data stores was like swatting flies with a bulldozer. You could do it, but it wasn't very effective. What virtual volumes does, it's an extension to either SCSI and therefore runs on iSCSI and Fiber Channel or to NFS that expands the visibility of the storage array down to the individual VMDK. So now I can start using all of the functionality that storage array has, and I can snapshot one VM at a time, or in a later version, because 1.0 doesn't support replication, I can set up a replication schedule for each VM, or I can set up replication schedule policies and say this group of VMs should be managed and, you know, we should replicate them once a day, but this other group we should replicate once every 15 minutes because that's where our databases are running. The other thing is that now that the array has the visibility into which IOs belong to which VM, it also allows arrays to do old tricks like read ahead by identifying what a series of sequential IOs were and figuring that if he asked for block one and then he asked for block two, the next thing he's going to do is ask for block three. Let me read 3 through 20 just so I hold it in case. When you had a bunch of VMs in one data store, the array couldn't see that those were sequential IOs because they were interspersed with all the other IOs from other VMs that were accessing that same data store.
Well, okay, my brain's taking all this in because I'm starting to think about my lab setup. Since I've never been a full-time virtualization administrator, I'm always thinking about storage and feeling like I'm one step behind in these conversations. But so that, again, a virtual volume, you're now passing through information about the virtual machines all the way down through so that the storage is aware of them if he knows about virtual volumes, or is it really the other way around?
Think of a virtual volume as a microlun. And the real reason we could only have 255 volumes on a VMware cluster is that the SCSI ID field is only 8 bits. But there's also a sublun ID and a sub-sublun ID. So for each one of those volumes, there could be 255 subluns and 255 sub-subluns of each one of those, which means now every VMDK can get its own identifier. And when IOs come in, they say, this is an IO for this block within this VMDK. And so now the storage system can say, oh, so he wants block 7 from that VMDK, and next he wants block 8. That's sequential. Let me read the next 20 blocks ahead, where before all he was seeing was what block within the LUN where everything was all mixed together.
So let's say I'm actually running virtual volumes. Are there a particular sort of workload that's going to benefit from vVols more than others?
There's a substantial difference between a good and a bad vVols implementation. In a good vVols implementation, the storage array can do the kind of things we've been talking about, identify sequential reads. It can also identify sequential writes and say, oh, this is a transaction log LUN, and therefore I shouldn't cache it because he's only going to read it back in the event of a disaster. It is conceivable that databases would have a little bit bigger performance advantage because their behavior is more well known. But mostly what vVols really means is an improvement in manageability, because in addition to defining this micro LUN structure, VMware also defined the control plane. Ethan, you're a network guy. And so this is going to sound very SDN-ish because VMware has defined VASA 2.0, which is an external control plane that manages the array. And it can be a process that runs literally external to the array and as a VM or as a series of VMs, or it can be a process in the array, but it's an IP channel even for a fiber channel array through which vCenter can provision vVols and delete vVols and do all of that management. And so when you connect your vCenter server to an array that's running vVols, that array reports through this VASA provider, through this control plane, all the capabilities it has. That might be all the RAID levels it has or snapshot schedules, whatever the vendor wants to publish.
But again, it's less about performance as such, so it's not as big of a concern which workload you're putting on it, generally speaking, and more about the manageability that you get out of it.
Yes.
Which isn't to say some particularly forward-thinking vVol implementations might perform better in certain circumstances, like you were saying.
There are openings for performance optimization. Frankly, the biggest performance change is going to come at backup time. Because today, if you use the vStorage API for data protection, the first thing vCenter does is make a VMware snapshot of the machine you're backing up.
And we know that you love VMware snapshots, Howard.
And that is the data source for the backup application. Since VMware snapshots are awful, while the backup is running, your application will run at best half as fast. That I frequently see that when we create a VMware snapshot, we see a 3 or 4 times reduction in the IOPS and 4 or 5 times increase in the latency of accessing the storage through that vSphere snapshot. That snapshot exists as long as it takes to complete the backup to copy the data. And then there's even more IO on your storage system to unwind that VMware snapshot. With vVols, instead of a VMware snapshot, that can be an array snapshot. And with modern storage arrays, the performance impact of having that snapshot exist could be 1 or 2%, not 3 or 4 times. And so there's where we're going to see performance. And then that also means now I don't have to run backups in the backup window while nothing else is going on, since the backup has a much smaller impact on performance. The backup window expands.
Plus one to that. On a different vein, Howard, I'm curious. I don't think a lot of people are going to go out and necessarily buy a new array that supports vVols. So for those that are having to deal with their existing array, can I take advantage of virtual volumes today? What do I need to do to actually move forward to use this technology at kind of a high level?
To some extent, it depends what kind of storage you have now. Some vendors are offering vVols as a firmware upgrade, going back a substantial ways. Others, you're going to have to buy a new array because the current ones can't support it for one reason or another. Interestingly, you can apply a software layer and get vVols functionality. A couple of vendors that do that come to mind, Atlantis Computing, who is a client, their USX software layer can use flash or memory in the host to accelerate access to existing storage. And since they layer their file system on top of whatever the existing storage is, they can provide vVols functionality and snapshots through their file system. Primary Data, David Flynn, who is the founder of Fusion.io's new company, has a more grandiose scheme for building large-scale global namespaces and access methods. And again, because they're layering their file system data layout on top, you can use that to add vVols to existing storage. If you just want to play with vVols, there's a version of the virtual VNX that EMC allows people to download that has the vVols functionality.
Okay, so I'm either SOL because I've got an old array. I could potentially look for some kind of firmware upgrade that'll allow me to get the functionality, or I'm just really lucky I've already got it somewhere. Alternatively, I can layer on a third-party solution that sits kind of in the middle between the data stream. You mentioned Atlantis as an example. Usually, I would imagine that's some kind of server-side performance type deal.
Yeah, it's kind of partially a server-side cache like a Pernix or a FlashSoft, but they also integrate that with managing the whatever storage you let them see, and so they have their own file system, and the file system is where things like snapshots live.
Got it. And then alternatively, the VNX downloadable version just to play with. And for those listening, not for production, I would assume, just to tinker around with how it all
works.
Yes,
yeah, the EMC clearly does not support that in production.
Yeah, I run a virtual machine that's on a virtual machine. You know, sounds like fun. Mr. Marks, it's been a pleasure. I think I've become smarter.
Who are you calling Mr.?
Sir? Are you knighted yet? I didn't get that.
Your grace.
Excellent. This has been enlightening. I know my brain has wrinkled a number of times, which means I'm learning something, and hopefully all of the DataNauts listeners have as well. I know people want to know more about what you talk about at Deep Storage and the Greybeards podcast. So where can we find more links to your internet presence?
I blog semi-regularly at networkcomputing.com, as many of us have been associated with that fine website over the years. You can find Greybeards on Storage on iTunes or on Silverton Consulting, which is Ray's website /GBOS. And at deepstorage.net, I blog about what's going on in the lab and about the work that we do for our clients, proving that their storage systems actually work the way they say they do.
That is it for today's DataNauts podcast. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter, and my blog is ethancbanks.com. Chris is at Chris Wall on Twitter, and his blog is wallnetwork.com. And for more superb DataNauts content, crabwalk on over to packetpushers.net to partake on the bountiful feast of podcast goodness. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
I wanted to ask like 83 more questions.
what I wouldn't give for clean and managed cables.
Flipping a coin. Call it.
Heads.
It was tails.
Oh, okay.
So what does that mean?
So what is that? As the coin tosser, I thought you knew.